afternoon, we'll form a subcommittee of the committee of the House Committee on Revenue. How's that? For April 18, 2005. It's a minute after 1 o'clock. It's hearing room A. And we have a number of bills for public hearing today. And we will open this afternoon by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2237. Mass?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2237, as the rest of the bills of today, deals with the lottery, the Oregon lottery. And this one in particular requires that the Lottery Commission adopts in law, as is required here, an alternative dispute resolution process in the contract with the retailers. And in that sense, the bill injects a shall, a more definitive type of requirement than may, rather than using may, in every contract of the retailer in order to make that the way of resolving disputes with contract managers. Now, it needed to be mentioned that today there exists a process, however, it's not necessarily a law. And the amendment also requires this new type of dispute resolution is to be in conformity with ORS 183.502, and just to bring it into perspective for you, 183.502 is in your staff measure summary SMS, and what it basically talks about is that the option is open already for agencies to utilize that process, and it goes into quite a bit of detail on how the process is employed through the Attorney General and AG and the Marco Hatfield School of Government that's in Portland State, and how they do the dispute resolution process. I've included that just for your reference to be able to refer to it if need be.
Now, those are model rules, Maz, and are those mandatory methods of dispute resolution?
Well, the Mr. Chair, the in the statutes is are very defined on how they go. However, once they are implemented, there is quite a bit of flexibility with where the college school of government, that is Mark Hatfield School of Government, could put into fill in the bones, if you will, or fill the meat on the bones of the process. But the process does exist as a skeleton quite explicitly in the rules, in the statutes, that is. That is a choice for any agency to go with it, providing that it actually increases efficiency, increases public agency satisfaction, as in number 7, and decreases the cost of resolving the disputes. Those are the outcomes that are put as a condition for going on that.
So when this bill requires the commission shall develop the dispute resolution process required by this section, this new legal section, in conformity with the ORS 183.502, that's the 183.502 is basically the 3 or 4 step process, or multi-step process, I guess, that takes it through that.
That's correct. Okay. However, the statutes today are more of open that they may. This makes it shall.
Thank you. This is Lottery Day, and let's see. We now have a committee that's a full committee of members. We still lack at least one, but we'll open this as a committee of the actual Committee on Revenue and invite Dale Penn. Dale, come forward if you would, please. This is Oregon Lottery Day in the House Revenue Committee, Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I saw from the listing of bills. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. I'm here on House Bill 2237. We had supplied a fiscal impact statement on this bill. I simply wanted to explain that the process that is already in place, we have very few disputes that go beyond these processes, and at any time, if a retailer is unhappy with the decision that the lottery does make, there always is a judicial solution to have a judge review the situation. But at the present time, what we do is there would be a determination made by the retailer contract section. There's a supervisor of that section, and there is an appeal to that supervisor. If after reconsideration by the supervisor and review of it, if there still isn't a decision that the retailer is happy with, then the matter would be brought to my office and it again would be reviewed and an analysis of the situation, any further evidence or information that could be available. If at that time, after the director made a decision, that the retailer still didn't appreciate the ruling or the decision, then there is a citizen commission, the lottery commission, that is available to hear those disputes. Again, we have had very few that have ever gone to that length. As I view this, I do have some concerns in that I believe there are times this is a process that is available, and there would be times when it would be appropriate to use it. However, what we have seen is that reconsideration by the agency itself has resolved these things to the point that in the 6 months that I've been the director, I have seen one of these, and it really came down to a situation of a need to change the law. And there is a bill presently proceeding through the Senate at this time that would give some discretion. The lottery did not have discretion in that one particular circumstance. So it wasn't a complaint with the lottery itself. It was a more of an issue of what the law allowed. So our concern is that this is an extra layer. It is not necessary. We have not seen a situation that this would give rise to the need to have a statute to mandate this process. But if it is the legislature's will to have the lottery go down this road, we're open to doing so.
So, Chair Penn, your position is that because you haven't had to use any kind of dispute resolution or other legal means at this particular point to resolve with the lottery game retailers, that it probably shouldn't be in statute. It would serve no good function or purpose to have it in statute.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, because it is a discretionary issue now that if we did have a situation come up, we could certainly make use of this. We do work with the state police and the Attorney General's office in disputes and investigations, and I would certainly be open to this in an appropriate situation.
How are disputes presently? You're telling us that basically those are resolved well before it ever gets to that point. And you said you submitted a fiscal. I assume that's to the Legislative Fiscal Office. Estimated fiscal cost to implement a rule?
Mr. Chair, we did submit a fiscal impact, but we didn't assign a particular amount because we didn't know how many of these this new procedure would apply to. As I said, it's been minimal, if at all, okay, on the informal process. So we didn't put a dollar amount. We just put in this information, basically the information I've just given you.
So to adopt the rule would be one thing. To actually go to the alternative dispute resolution process would be quite another.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for Director Penn? Yes, Representative Olson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Penn, I'm just kind of curious, how many of these complaints end up getting in front of you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, how many of these get in front of me?
Yeah. The process I heard was you started out kind of with the retail contract section, then went to you, and then the Citizen Lottery Commission. So I'm just kind of curious.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, I've only been director for 6 months, and I've said that I haven't had any come to me except for one, which was not an issue about the decision made by the lottery, but was an issue about the discretion the lottery had by statute. And in fact, those retailers and others have gone about and introduced a bill here to give additional discretion to the lottery in that one situation. I think it will be resolved. But I have not seen a need for this statute, certainly in the 6 months that I've been director.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Dale, I just have a quick question. I guess I'm like you. I'm not sure what exactly we're doing here. But in our staff summary at the bottom, and it was made mention, the lottery works regularly with the Oregon State Police and the Attorney General's Office on contract disputes. If it's a civil contract dispute, what's the Oregon State Police involvement in negotiating? Or I guess I missed something here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Boquist, the state police would not be involved in negotiating the dispute. The Attorney General's office may be involved in that part of it. But there may be the need for investigative information. And in fact, some of the times what comes up is that there has been misconduct or even the point of criminal misconduct at a retail establishment where lottery products were sold. And there's a need to do an investigation, and that is when we would ask the state police to assist.
Let's follow up, Madam Chair. So what we're really, this is the crux, in your opinion, that we're trying to address with this or wherever it came from. It is actual individual contract violations that either on your side or on their side. Is that the gist? You understand we're trying to go with this, sir?
Mr. Chair and Representative Boquist, that's my understanding. Yes.
Further questions, Mr. Penn? Seeing none, thank you very much. I have no one else signed up to speak on this, so I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2237 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2585.
Mazin? Madam Chair and members of the committee, the House Bill 2585 tries to put a cap or a limit, if you will, on the establishments that are allowed to have video lottery, to have that total revenue out of that source not be more than 50% of the revenues of that total business, if you will. At this time, it seems that the lottery have an existing rules that they go with coming from a 1994 case of the Ecumenical Ministries versus the Oregon State Lottery, in which the issue or the question whether the establishment was a casino or not has been determined legally as whether it's a 60% of total or not. At that type of measure, if you will, or that yardstick, the lottery assumes that anybody that goes over the 60%, they will be put on a corrective plan in order to either reduce their revenues from the lottery sources or do otherwise, or basically they will have a contract termination. Now, if this law gets into, or this bill gets into law, gets affected, you would have at this time something in the neighborhood of 59 retailers that generate more than 50% of their sales from lottery. That would mean that they would have to come into compliance somehow. Now, whether that compliance means that they have immediately to come into it, because this law would be more inclusive than the contract, which does not stipulate that. If that is the case, then they would have to come up into compliance immediately, and that might impact some of the revenue that they generate, which is about $35 million a biennium. However, the extra card, I guess, that we have to deal with here is the process of no pun intended.
Yeah, right.
The as in, you know,
that's fun. The The lottery is trying to get into the line games and renegotiate, or however it turns out to be, the contracts on the different establishment. If that becomes part of the new encompassing contract, if you will, that whole picture will start looking differently at this point, and these people would have to come into compliance almost immediately. What does that mean is still out to be determined in how quickly they would have to either come into that ceiling, if you will, or how quickly they would have others come in to fill the gap that if they go out of business, others will do. And in that sense, because of that reality, I don't see a revenue impact per se in the long run. There might be something within the disturbance at the time until they come into that. However, in the long run, the market would probably allow for more people to fill in that gap, and does not mean necessarily we will see a $35 million reduction in revenue. Desmond.
Questions of Masson? Well, then we will ask Mr. Penn to get right back up here and get very far. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. I am here in opposition to this bill. This is a situation that there is no definition of the term dominant use, dominant purpose. It was a phrase that the Oregon Supreme Court utilized in establishing that at that time, retailer contracts and retailers in Oregon that had five machines were not violating the casino prohibition language in the Oregon Constitution. And the Supreme Court made a statement that as long as their dominant use and dominant purpose was not as a casino, then it wouldn't violate this term. And the Supreme Court looked at the fact that there was a limit on the number of machines. At that time, five. At the present time, six. And then other factors, and in fact the lottery has traditionally over the years looked at other factors, such as how is this business being portrayed? What is the amount of square footage dedicated to gambling activities as opposed to other types of activities? No retailer is able to sell video lottery products unless they have established their business for 6 months in operation, successful operation, before they can even apply to be a video retailer. So there are a lot of other issues that are looked at in this definition. When the Lottery Commission first defined dominant use, dominant purpose for the issue of rules in the lottery, the percentage was 67%. That amount was pulled down to 60% about 5 years ago in anticipation of line games revenue coming into the marketplace. Line games were not authorized at that time, but that was the stated purpose for it. What has happened now is that over the years we have audited over 2,200 retailers. Since 1997, only 33 were found to be out of compliance. And we automatically, at this time, will monitor and audit retailers when they approach 50%, between 50 and 60%. And so we've done so. We've had 33 retailers over those years that have either modified their sales, have changed their business operation, or they have been dropped from video lottery. If this bill becomes law, there are two issues that come into place. First of all is the issue that was identified for you, that we are presently being asked by the legislature and the governor to increase our revenues by 22% from this biennium just to meet the base budget figure in next biennium's budget. we go from $770 million to $933 million in the next biennium just to fit the base budget. My concern is that there are retailers that are in the 50% range that automatically go in to some kind of process, depending on the effective date of this bill, that we can endanger those revenues. As I view the operation of Video Lottery trying to establish a 22% increase in sales, any reduction in the capability to increase sales brings greatly into question the ability of the lottery to produce that $933 million next biennium. So that is one concern that I have. This is a situation that we believe is appropriate as it has been established over the years. The court had the ability to examine it a number of years ago. I believe there's been good guidance and good discretion used in this standard, and because of that and because of the danger to the viability of the state's budget in the next 2-year cycle, we would urge that you not pass this bill.
Representative Riley has a question.
Actually, more of a statement, Madam Chair. This bill came from the Trade and Economic Development Committee, and being a member of that committee, I thought, and the fact that our Chair Lim is out of the country, I thought it appropriate that possibly I'd give you what I think is his reason for bringing this bill forward, and he's concerned that the lottery was told by the state Supreme Court that businesses could not be the primary business of any business. It had to be secondary. And in his view, and I'm not saying it's my view, but I wanted to express his view as I know it. In his view, if you have 50% or more revenue from something, that is your primary business. So I just wanted to, and Director Penn was there and heard Chair Lim say these very words, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to do that.
Further questions?
Madam Chair, could I give one little response about that?
You may.
If that'd be okay. I appreciate it very much. I was present at that hearing, and we had the Attorney General's office, we had the Governor's legal counsel, and myself to talk about dominant use and dominant purpose. And I think it is very important to remember that the term is dominant use. We may, as lay people, say that means primary business, but I don't believe in the context of the decision that it does. And that's why you have to take into all these other factors. What does it look like? How does it operate? What is square footage? How is it advertised? How is it portrayed? All of these other issues, and the limit on the number of machines that is presently there. So we do believe that, and I think the Governor's Council and Attorney General's Office all were consistent in that opinion back to Chair Lim that this rule was constitutional at this point.
Representative Olson, did you have a question?
I'm done, thanks.
Further question, Representative Olson.
I'm not clear on what constitutes or how the courts have defined a casino. So, Mazin or Mr. Penn, what constitutes...
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, the difficulty is the Supreme Court did not really define casino. It simply said that as long as, other than by using this phrase, if a location with some amount of business and machines had a dominant use and dominant purpose of gambling, then it could violate the casino prohibition. And that is where this phrase got picked up and has been utilized. But there was not a clear decision about that other than the fact that the court did say that the present retailer network that was in place at that time with 5 machine limits and some of these other controls about being in business for 6 months, advertising and everything else, they said that does not violate the casino prohibition.
Seeing no further questions, thank you. And I'll ask Mark Nelson to come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, and today I'm representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. I am not to be taken as a smaller version of Bill Perry. Mr. Perry is...
Nor a younger version?
Nor a younger version.
Wow, it's that hard.
You would have to add that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we, along with the lottery, are in opposition to House Bill 2825. As has been explained, this measure effectively drops the 60% standard to 50%. As Mr. Penn has indicated, there has been legal action on this issue, and as I remember that particular opinion, and maybe Mr. Penn can correct me, the court had a choice of deciding whether they wanted to use the term majority use and chose to use the term dominant use, which in our mind and in that opinion meant that it was something more than a majority and something less than something else. And as you can see, I've passed out a copy of Oregon Administrative Rule 177040061. This is the lottery's administrative rule regarding dominant use, and you can find, as Mr. Penn has explained, a very detailed process by which the dominant use is arrived at. And you see the various definitions there. And then on page 2, you'll see that the director shall consider the following factors. It's in the middle of the page to make a final determination. Floor space analysis, how that's calculated, income analysis, and then a process by which the director and timelines in which the director can first, as Mr. Penn said, they determine in the first 6 months what kind of income they're bringing in, and they apply that back to these standards. There's then a process by which, if it's determined that they are, it is a dominant use, that they can then notify in writing. There is a process by which that retailer must come into compliance and then remain in compliance in a period of time in which he continues to be he or she continues to be reviewed. So we believe that the Lottery Commission has taken the court's decision and has applied that decision back to a very, I think, thoughtful process by which they lay out how you must stay in compliance. Now, everyone can say, well, I believe dominant is something less or something different. From our point of view, dropping it from 60 to 50% is simply reducing first the income that is available to the state of Oregon and, of course, to the retailer, and it eliminates and will, in fact, eliminate many retailers from that process. As again, we ask the question, why the legislation? For what problem are we trying to solve? We think it does, in fact, as Mr. Penn has indicated, cause many, many other problems. Top 10% of the retailers, the top 10% producing retailers, make about, I believe, the number is about 30% of the income. And these are retailers that are generating for the state at least $1 million a year in terms of income. So they are the best and the largest producers that, in effect, will be impacted by this. As Mr. Penn has said, there have been. It's not like this process has not been used. 33 retailers have found to be out of compliance in a review. I think he mentioned 2,200. That indicates that the process is working and that it is a level that we think is appropriate. So, in addition, I have given you another piece there from the Legislative Council, and this is regards to an additional bill we may be testifying on today. But this letter indicates in the second paragraph, which I think is important for all of your deliberations regarding the lottery. The people created the lottery commission in the Constitution, which makes that commission very different than other state agencies, as the letter indicates. And it states, when the people created the commission in the Constitution, the people gave the commission the authority to administer the lottery. The people also gave the Legislative Assembly some authority in relation to the lottery, such as how to spend net revenues for economic development. The people did not grant the Legislative Assembly the authority to tell the Commission how to run the lottery. Now, what does that mean? And as Mr. Hendricks says in his full last paragraph of that page, any action by the Legislative Assembly that unduly burdens or restricts the power of the Commission to establish or operate the state lottery is subject to constitutional challenge. If the Legislative Assembly wants to have the ability to tell the Commission how to run the lottery, whether by limiting the types of games it can offer or the amount of commission it may pay to the video lottery game retailers, the Legislative Assembly will need to refer a constitutional amendment to the people for their approval. Now, there's a lot of gray area in there. I just bring this up that as you that balance between what the people meant in the Constitution in terms of giving powers to the lottery commission and the balance reserved to the legislature, because it is a constitutional amendment, is one that I think causes us some concern. Whether the 60% to 50% is in fact unduly impacting or removing the authority from the commission, that's an issue for you to consider. We think in terms of setting rates that it's absolutely clear that that the commission must set the rates, and that's an opinion that has been held by previous legislative assemblies on this issue. So that's also for your consideration.
Questions, Mr. Nelson? Seeing none,
thank you
very much. I have no one else signed up, and I don't see anyone jumping up on House Bill 2585, so I will close this public hearing on House Bill 2585 and open public hearing on House Bill 2671. Nazan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2671 also deals with the lottery issues, and it's very interesting in the sense that it actually amends the sections in the law that limits the number of machines. Now, remember, the terminals are limited to be 6 per establishment, and then at the races or the race meet, it could place 10. This would increase it to 50. Now, if you look at, there's the first thing that comes to mind is how big of an establishment this would be, and were the issues that we were talking about as far as the casino definitions and where the Supreme Court decisions in the 1994 case, all these issues come into place. And if you compare this to the Indian casinos, for example, the smallest that runs about 100 machines, and so that's in the state, of course, and the largest, such as Spirit Mountain, has about 1,500. So to have 50 in one place, and presuming there's many assumptions that need to be done with this bill, and if this to go further needs to probably be clarified, is whether this establishment will be open more than the seasonal type of opening that it usually is, since the races are on a seasonal basis. So if this is expanded to all time, all the year, you're in front of a new player in the market, if you will. And for you, Madam Chair, this will be a real nexus of
I had to do that, didn't you?
Yeah, of machines and races and so on. You'll have a nexus of betting and gambling, if you will, and whether that establishes and crosses the threshold will remain to be seen. However, assuming all of that is dissolved and that we do have a new establishment of this sort after certain amendments and changes to the bill, you could expect some revenue increases by this bill, and on the tune of about $1.2 million or so a year. So you would have a revenue impact statement in front of you that is not completely finalized because of the different complexities that need to be answered first before we could further allocate the different types of revenues coming from where, and the nexus issue.
Questions of Mazin from the committee? We have a F1 being handed out. Seeing no questions, I'm going to ask our colleague, Representative Steve March, to lead us off. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like you're discussing a very good bill that's come before you. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. Let me say at the outset, I think that, one, yes, this is a revenue-producing bill. It provides a small and convenient factor for people who do wish to play some of the state's games. It's not putting in a huge number of terminals, but they're putting them into a location that is smoke-free. So if any of you wish to play a game, this is a new place to play, and it's smoke-free. And if any of you had gone to the existing locations, they're all, I have not found one that is smoke-free to date. Now, maybe there are some, and I haven't found them. But it also allows the video lottery terminals in liquor stores, it allows the liquor stores to have an additional source of revenue that they are currently cannot have. They will have to work out agreements with OLCC. We've already talked about they can't take out 20 feet of liquor shelves to put in these machines. They have to put them in within their existing space, and probably take up some space that they currently use for mix or something like that. The liquor agents have been working on a low commission for some time. This would allow an additional source of income to help them upgrade their stores. I've been told by some members that if they had this little additional income, they might go ahead and open an additional day. A number of stores haven't taken advantage of opening 7 days a week, which are currently allowed to by law. It also provide a venue for tourists who travel through the state and would stop and, getting a package. They may help contribute to economic development. They may, or schools, or our park system, all through the lottery. And if it produces about $1.2 million, that's going to go a long way to paying for that research and development that we want to do for the state. So I think it's a good bill. I be happy to work with you on any particular amendments that need to be made. And with that, I'll stop and answer any questions.
And Representative March, if Mazin would please go back to square one on this. Your description was only the increase of...
We're looking at the wrong bill, Mazin.
Yeah, we're
okay.
We got two different bills.
He's on 2791.
Okay, Representative March, you're signed up on the wrong bill.
My assistant. Well, thank you. My assistant put it on the wrong bill.
And can we take your words? Have you written your remarks?
No, but I'd be happy to send you something written, and please can.
We will take your words. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, if you will indulge me. I apologize sincerely, but if you looked at confusion here, I hadn't read ahead. Somebody obviously had. And your name is on here, so I invited you first.
Madam Chair, and
we will take your remarks into consideration when we get to the appropriate
thing. All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Representative
Mark. My mistake.
There we go.
I'm sure this is.
It makes sense with that.
Right. Well, I know. I don't understand all of that.
We'll continue on with House Bill 2671 and public session, public hearing. I have signed up to testify Larry Campbell, Dave Benson, Dave Nelson, and Jack Root. You gentlemen want to figure out how you want to sort yourselves out? Come forward.
Two and two.
Two and two is fine. I can count that way.
We're on the right one now.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was excited. I mean, when Representative Mark shows up in favor of our bill, I thought we really got it made here. But I'm Larry Campbell, representing Magna Entertainment. Magna operates a horse racing at Portland Meadows Track. And I might say that we've been looking for a number of ways of saving the horse industry in the state of Oregon. One of them was to come to the legislature and ask that you give us a return on the $1.2 million worth of taxes that the industry pays to the state. Now, that didn't seem very practical to us. Another was to find a way, since we were forced to close our dog track, which was also a Magna operation in Oregon, because of lack of handle and because we couldn't afford to keep two operations going with the lost revenue, would be to have year-round simulcasting. We have a bill that has just passed out of committee in the Senate, which you will see hopefully within a couple of weeks, providing year-round simulcasting, and that will help the Magna track with about 50% of its lost revenues. The other area of deep concern for us is the horsemen themselves, and we have a number of representatives in various groups that will be testifying today. Magna Entertainment acquired Portland Meadows in 2001. Unfortunately, since that the time of MEC's acquisition, as a result of competitive changes, the horse racing industry in Oregon is in jeopardy. The racing industry supports 3,000 Oregon jobs, primarily in the agricultural sector or directly related to horse racing. The economic impact of the racing industry on the Oregon economy exceeds $150 million a year. Since 2001, there's been continued expansion, as you understand and know, of Indian casinos in the state. We recently saw the governor agree to off-reservation casino for the Warm Springs Tribe and Cascade Locks. For weeks, we've been following the progress of a plan by the Washington Cowlitz Tribe and the Connecticut Mohegan Tribe to build a major casino in La Center, Washington, which is just 16 miles north of Portland Meadows. We say once that casino is built, it would be one of the largest in the West. It would be like a 90-pound Oreck vacuum cleaner sucking dollars out of Oregon, and it would not only be our racing dollars, but it will be the lottery dollars, and it will be casino dollars for our casinos. Substantial increases in video poker machines has also taken a toll on wagering dollars. The recent decision to allow line games is the most recent challenge, and or I should say challenge or opportunity, depending on the action of this committee and the legislature. As these competitive activities have grown, the decline in Oregon live handle, those are the dollars actually bet on live horse racing in Oregon, have gone from approximately $24 million in 1995 to $18.2 million in 2000 and $14.9 million in 2004. Because of the reduced live handle, horse owners have been seriously impacted. During the last 4 years, Magna has invested $21 million in purchasing Portland Meadows operating rights, the real estate interest, and track improvements. Due to the previous owner's failure to correct the problem, the EPA closed our operation in 2002 because of stormwater runoff in the Columbia Slough. It cost $1 million to correct the problem so racing could resume. In addition, Magna's operating loss has been almost $7 million in that same time period. This legislation would provide an estimate $500,000 per year for the industry, with half going to maintaining Magna's ability to operate and the other half being provided for purses for the horses. The industry has been on pins and needles for a number of years, and like a cat that's used 8 of its 9 lives, we're on the edge. If Portland Meadows goes under, all the race programs at our fairs are also likely to fail. That includes Grants Pass, Prineville, Union, Tillamook. We have two bills, as I mentioned, in the legislature, Senate Bill 929 and this bill. And in essence, we can say that without these two, it's likely that Magna will not be able to continue the operation of the second track in Oregon, having lost the first. If we're unable to find a solution to declining income and increasing negative financial results, I believe Magna will have no choice but to pull up stakes and close Portland Meadows in the same way it closed the Greyhound Park. We're trying hard to give the horse industry an opportunity to succeed. We need your help. Some years ago, we passed a bill in the legislature allowing 75 machines at the two racetracks. The Attorney General at that time closed his eyes, saw 75 machines, and said, "Looks like a casino." So the governor vetoed that bill. Every action that we've taken in the last 8 years to try to improve the plight of the horse people in the state of Oregon has been vetoed, passed by the legislature and vetoed. We have a new governor. It happens that that new governor is the Attorney General that saw those 75 machines as a casino. The indication that we have at this point in time is that, indeed, we will not have a problem with this bill from a casino standpoint with 50 machines. I'd also like to say that we waited until now, and we thank Mr. Chairman for bringing this bill to you at this point in time. We waited until the agreement had been reached between the Lottery Commission and the Restaurant Association and their retailers before we brought this bill forward. Because as you'll note by the amendment on this, and we held it off until we found exactly what the agreement was going to be with the lottery, the amendment would allow 24.8% of the revenues from these machines to go to the industry, which is the average of all of the other retail machines in the state. We recognize that this is an unusual way of dealing with an unusual problem. You recognize that we already have allocated 10 machines per racetrack, which is different than all other retailers in the state. This bill is very narrowly written so it only applies to licenses, the license at Portland Meadows. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to my colleague who is a horseman. By the way, I probably should declare a conflict of interest, shouldn't I? My horse won yesterday, so we paid for the feed for the last 60 days.
Unfortunately, mine ran third and didn't pay for the feed. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Benson. I'm president of the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. We're a nonprofit benevolent organization representing owners, trainers, their assistant trainers, and grooms racing thoroughbred horses throughout the state of Oregon. We have presently in excess of 1,500 members, and I'm here today requesting your support to approve passage of HB 2671-1, allowing the 50 online games as previously mentioned. The Oregon HBPA is extremely concerned about the plight of horse racing in the state of Oregon and at Portland Meadows, but I'm more concerned about the people of the state of Oregon who depend on racing to provide a living for themselves and their families. Without passage of this bill, Magna Entertainment, the owner of the racing rights at Portland Meadows, will leave Oregon. And income for these Oregonians will cease. Not only does horse racing provide income for our members, but also contributes toward the income of over 3,000 other Oregonians involved with our industry, including our track veterinarians, our farriers, jockeys, hay and straw farmers, tax suppliers and equipment suppliers such as trucks and trailer sales. We must also consider the income of our track officials, our paramutual clerks, our waitresses and waiters, guards and maintenance employees, who there, likewise, their salaries would be affected. Our summer fair race meets, many of them are dependent on the success and the operation of Portland Meadows for their survival. Our summer fairs at Burns, Grants Pass, Prineville, Union, and Tillamook, and the survival of those fairs are dependent on horse racing. That will also cease if Portland Meadows goes away. Horsemen derive income from a purse account, which is generated from a small percentage of the daily handle, that handle being that which is wagered on simulcasting and our daily racing programs. We, Oregon horsemen and women, presently have the dubious distinction of racing for the lowest purses of any Class 1 racetrack in the United States. And our members are presently just surviving. Horse racing in Oregon has existed since the turn of the 20th century. Many of our horsemen have been involved in racing their entire life, and they have no skills other than horse racing, that if we lost horse racing, they have no skills that would provide them to go on and find other jobs. If horse racing ceases in the state of Oregon, many of those people would be dependent on welfare for their existence, and that is a true fact. Passage of this legislation would provide an estimated additional $250,000 towards our yearly purse account at Portland Meadows, or approximately $350 additional per race. While this amount seems insignificant, every dollar directed toward our members' livelihood is extremely important. We sincerely hope that you will favor this legislation. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. Any questions for Dave or Mr. Campbell? Yes, Representative Galizio is recognized.
Good afternoon. I had two questions. Does Magna, do you have, I mean, I've heard the term racino used in other states, right, horse racing and casino. I don't know if you, maybe I shouldn't use that term, but do you have experience, or does Magna have experience with this in other states? And then in terms of other states, how would this compare to other states in terms of, let's say, the number of terminals that exist in horse racing facilities?
Sure, we have Mr. Chairman and Representative Lugo, we have a difficult situation in Oregon because you cannot have a private casino, and the racinos are actually racetracks with casinos associated with them.
Okay.
The only way that could be done in Oregon is if the governor were to authorize an off-reservation casino at Portland Meadows, and then we could work in conjunction with them to build a racetrack. Magna is finding more and more success in states where racinos are available, or gambling in addition to horse racing is available. And in essence, that, of course, is what we're hoping to do here. We're trying to stand on our own 2 feet as opposed to ask for assistance from the state in keeping the industry going.
Mr. This is more just a comment. The jobs are really critical, and the financial aspect is important, but also just as somebody who grew up in Southern California, and my parents used to take me to the morning workouts to watch the horses, and it was great. And I love horse racing. I think it's a great sport. So I think whatever we can do to keep racing in peers would be great. So.
Thank you.
We'd love to invite you out.
I'm ready. Got no money, but
we don't either anymore.
Representative Berger is recognized.
Yeah, you made reference to county horse races. How many county fairs have horse racing associated with them?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Berger, there are 5.
And do
follow-up, Representative?
Do horses that race in those kinds of venues then race in Portland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's basically where most of the horses come from. But Portland Meadows provides the impetus for year-round activity, even though we're only racing for 6 months during the year. But the fact of the matter is those same horses are the ones that populate most of those county fairs.
Follow-up, President.
Thank you. You were in the room when we had the previous discussion about the 60 and 50 and that issue. Being open only 6 months out of the year, is this going to be an issue with regard to lottery?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burr, we would join Bill Penn in his opposition to that bill from a MAGA perspective, but I don't believe it will affect us because it depends on the way you look at the revenues. Mm-hmm. And our handle revenues are over $14 million.
Okay.
And as Dave mentioned, we're looking at about 200. And by the way, these figures we arrived at with the help of folks from the lottery, because we were concerned about how we identify figures. And these are conservative figures, but this proposal would provide about $250,000 a year for the purses and about $250,000 a year for the operation of the track.
Larry, your testimony indicates that that there was an EPA closure in 2002 because of stormwater running out of the Columbia Slough, and that's at the Portland Meadows. When I look at the actual takes in the handle at Portland Meadows, I see that from 2001 to 2002 there was a small decline, not nearly the decline that there had been from 2000 to 2001. But from 2002 to 2003, there was a rather substantial increase. How did that closure, the EPA closure of Portland Meadows, actually affect that handle?
Well, I think reopening it, reopening it is what allowed us to increase slightly in 2003. But the competition that we have for horse racing in the state of Oregon, are all the other things, the casinos, the lottery fund, any other gambling venue. And so one of the reasons that we feel that we really had to drop in 2004 is because of the additional machines that were put in and the additional activity that we face as far as competition is concerned. But not sure that answers your question, okay. But you'll notice that we did drop in 2002 from 2001.
Yes, sir. And the additional machines that you're referring to between 2003 and 2004, that was as a result of a legislative change from, what, five machines?
From five to six and from
six to
five to ten.
Okay.
Because we went from five to ten.
Okay. Other questions for either of these two witnesses? Representative Kong.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. Thank you. My only question is about the EPA situation. That's totally been rectified and everything is in conformity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kump, we're extremely pleased with the work that Magna has done in that arena, and it has been very successful. We do not believe that that's going to be a problem for us.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave Nelson and Jack Root.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Nelson. I I reside at 7479 Nelson Lane in Turner, Oregon, where my wife and I raised. Actually, it was a root and a box number when we bought the place, and the county was going to rename it Moore Lane, and so we called them up and said, "What are you going to name it Moore Lane for? We're the only ones that live here." And they said, "Well, what do you want to name it?" So my wife said, "We're going to name it Nelson Lane." And so the post office, the county went along with it. I've been,
Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, to continue. Been involved with horses and racing since the late 1960s, and have served as the chairman of the Quarter Horse Racing Association from 1973 to 1996, and have lobbied for Portland Meadows from 1977 to date. I'm a member of the American Quarter Horse Association Racing Committee. I have been for 8 years or longer, and serve on the Graded Stakes Subcommittee, as well as the MBNA. That's the bank that sponsors the challenge races that the American Quarter Horse Association sponsors. And the challenge is the Quarter Horse version of the Thoroughbred Breeders' Cup. All that just says that I've been in a unique position to see and be involved in the enormous changes that have come over racing in the last 20 or 30 years. Today in racing, there are two classes of states that are involved in racing, and those are those states that have slots and those states that do not have slots. As states made the decision to go after voluntary revenue in the form of gaming, some states made the decision to place their slot machines at their racetracks, and both, as a result, both the racetracks and the lotteries in those states have prospered. Other states made the decision to not involve the racing industry, and in those states, such as Oregon, the racing industry has suffered, and the lotteries have done well. In Oregon, just as a side, Mr. Chairman, there are approximately 50% of the state's lotteries are lottery machines. Video screens are in Multnomah County. That just surrounded Portland Meadows and Multnomah Kennel Club. Multnomah Kennel Club did not survive. Many of the states, some of the examples of states that collaborated with the racing industries include Louisiana, or include, Iowa at Prairie Meadows in Altoona. They now have 3,000 slots at Prairie Meadows. West Virginia and Louisiana. Louisiana recently expanded theirs from video poker machines to video slot machines and allowed casinos to be active there. Oklahoma has just negotiated an agreement between all of the tribes and the racing industry in Oklahoma and the state of Oklahoma, and New Mexico has allowed casinos at the racetracks in New Mexico. The breeding industry and the racing industry in those states have rebounded and, in fact, exploded, as you've seen purses go up from an average of $2,000 per race to nearly $10,000 or $15,000 per race. New Mexico is now looking at an average daily purse of $200,000 per day. And you divide that out by 10 races, and you can see you have a strong stakes program and you have a strong overnight racing program. Now other states are looking at adding video slot machines to their racetracks. Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Indiana, Kansas, Illinois, and Florida are all looking at putting slots at their racetracks in association with the racing industry. The state of Oregon, as Larry said earlier, has kept its foot on the racing industry while expanding its video gaming and negotiating expanded compacts with Indian tribes for Indian casinos. As I said, we've lost Multnomah Kennel Club and are now just teetering on the edge of losing Portland Meadows, which would then take down the local race meets at the counties. The Oregon Quarter Horse Association has about 200 members who are raising and racing quarter horses around the states. They buy hay, oats, feed, supplements, gas, diesel, pickup trucks, horse trailers, supplies at farms, use veterinarians, farriers, accountants, and lawyers. I just got my bill from my accountant, by the way.
Don't hold that against it.
They travel to race meets, stay in hotels, have breakfast in local cafes, and then celebrate with a dinner at the local diner that night. In other words, it's just good old economic activity. They bring their kids and grandkids out to climb on my hay piles and slide down the slides and pet the babies when they arrive in the spring. The racing industry is good economic activity. We sell our used racehorses all over the West to people involved in other kinds of horse-related activities. I've just sold some for barrel horses, for trail riding horses, and so on, and I keep a couple myself to ride in the mountains of northeastern Oregon when we go up there fishing in the summer. That money comes back into Oregon and is spent on furthering my program as well as putting money back into the economy. Portland Meadows is the engine that supports that whole activity. All of us quarter horse people urge you to support House Bill 2671. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dave?
Or Jack Root?
I thank you, Chairman Butler and Madam Vice Chair and representatives for hearing me out for a few minutes here. And my name is Jack Root. I have been involved in virtually all my adult life in the Oregon's horse racing industry, first as a veterinarian, now as a horse breeding farm operator and as a racehorse owner. Also, I took a little stint as a trainer. I'm the past president and 20-year-plus board member of the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association, which I'm representing today. In the next couple minutes, I hope to, you know, just briefly tell you why that I think the horse racing is extremely important to Oregon, why racing is struggling so badly right now, and then I want to personalize a little bit and tell you how that my own personal farm and family will be impacted. And then I want to tell you a little bit about how that alternative gambling that has been embraced by other states, as Dave just mentioned, has really helped their racing and breeding industries grow and prosper. When the lottery first arrived in Oregon, many of we Oregonians thought, okay, this is great. You know, this is going to be economic development for Oregon, and certainly many businesses have benefited greatly from having the lottery in Oregon. You know, as well as the state has, you know, certainly derived great benefits. many of the businesses that were not necessarily benefited by the lottery were certainly, you would have to say, no impact. On the other hand, Oregon's horse racing industry has been severely affected detrimentally by the lottery because, you know, for the first time we've had very significant competition. And then the competition, in addition to the lottery now, we have the Native American casinos, and now the internet gambling has really taken its toll on horse racing. Horse racing, as it is today, provides an estimated economic impact of over $150 million per year in Oregon. And, you know, this figure kind of comes from various industry sources. And in comparison of Oregon's industry size with other states that have had the money to, you know, afford very, very good economic studies. There are over 1,000 Oregonians employed full-time in horse racing in Oregon today. And you know, Larry mentioned that there's probably 3,000 employees total, and, you know, a lot of people are seasonal employees or part-time employees, but it's, you know, the horse racing industry is a huge employer for Oregon. Many of these horse industry jobs are filled by relatively unskilled people. And, you know, one of the beauties and one of the wonderful things about horse racing is that it gives many of these people, you know, truly a reason to get up every morning and, you know, something to go to work, something that they can be proud of, something that they can care for. It teaches them responsibility. It teaches them animal care. The horse racing provides a very, you know, very good quality agricultural lifestyle for many Oregonians. And, you know, there's race horses are raised throughout the state on many farms, helping to maintain the farmlands. The horse racing industry is a huge consumer of Oregon's agricultural products. On my own personal farm that we call Oakhurst Thoroughbreds, that's located in Newburgh, Oregon, we consume about 15 tons of Central Oregon's great high-quality alfalfa hay every 2 weeks. I should say every week we consume 15 tons. We get a semi-truck and trailer load every 2 weeks. We are the largest single customer of our local Wilco feed store, where we get about 5 to 6 tons of oats every week that are also grown in Oregon. Having the horse racing industry, you know, viable and prosperous in Oregon certainly is good for increasing the public awareness of agriculture in Oregon and, you know, how important it is. As is our farm, Oakhurst, family-owned and operated, many of the Oregon horse racing breeding and, you know, racing operations are family-owned and operated. And, you know, there's, at Portland Meadows today, I would just off the top of my head, I would say that 50% or more of the trainers that are there are also assisted by their own other family members, either their spouse or their children. Our own family, in addition to employing me full-time, my wife is our full-time bookkeeper. We have my oldest son is a full-time trainer. My second son works to manage the general farm activities and equipment maintenance and so forth. And I have a daughter-in-law that works full-time as a veterinary assistant. So this is, you know, a very, very important family business for us. Just because of the uncertainty of Magna being in operation this year, you know, our farm has been very fortunate in that we are, you know, at this point, we're certainly Oregon's largest thoroughbred breeding farm. We stand 10 stallions, of, you know, maybe among the best 10 stallions that Oregon's ever had. But already because of the uncertainty that the horse racing industry is currently facing because, you know, I'm worried about whether Magna is going to be in place to open Portland Meadows this fall. The mare's bred at our farm is down almost 20% from last year. And, you know, this is, you know, certainly a huge hit for us, but I think it's representative for the rest of the state. And it's because people have chosen to breed fewer mares. And they have, or, you know, some people are not breeding at all. Others are, you know, breeding fewer just because they don't know where the opportunity for the babies that they raise is going to be. So, you know, we can already see a pretty strong effect of that in our own business. And I'm sure that the other breeders in Oregon like us are feeling the same. You know, we were the racing industries. We were really excited, and we, you know, strongly, very enthused when Magna came to Oregon because Magna came with, you know, finally we had an operation that was stable, that was good, that was national, that really knew about and, you know, wanted racing to go. You know, we've had, you know, probably 2 decades of ownership uncertainty and mismanagement in Portland Meadows that, you know, has really hurt our crack. And finally, Magna has come along and they've done a darn good job. They've done a splendid job, and they have cleaned up the facility to better than it's ever been. They have made it to where you can get a great meal at Portland Meadows. And, you know, it's fun again to take friends and family to the races. But yet, in spite of all their hard work, because of their, you know, never-ending competition that they keep seeming to get new competition at every turn, the the overall handle that Magna has experienced through their Oregon racing operations has decreased 25% in the past 4 years that they've been here. And understandably, Magna is, you know, struggling for their own survival. And, you know, without Magna's survival, Oregon's horse breeding industry is going to go under. And, you know, we've got, you know, I think, like I said, I think it's very, very beneficial to us. And what will this bill accomplish? Well, I think that, you know, number one, it will certainly help horse racing compete better with the Oregon Lottery and the Native American casinos. It'll simply bring more people to the track. And, you know, the nice thing about it is that, you know, the husband might be a handicapper, well, at the same time, he can bring his wife and friends, and they might want to play the lottery terminals, which, you know, I think will benefit us all. This bill will help provide an environment in which horse racing can compete effectively with the other entertainment gambling enterprises that we now have in Oregon. It will allow a potential profit for racetrack management. You know, Magna, I don't think they're not here because they think they need to make more money. They're here simply because, you know, right now we need to fight for our survival, and then, you know, over time I think that it'll get better. And, you know, people are coming back to the racetrack with Magna's management. They've done a very good job. The facility is wonderful. The food is great. The racing is, you know, the best quality we can put up right now. But, you know, obviously if they can't make a profit, we can't expect them to stay. I think that, you know, in addition to the Senate Bill 929, I believe the number is, that was referred to the floor the other day, I think that, you know, the addition of these two bills will, you know, hopefully give Magna the incentive to stay, at least for a little while longer, to let the fruits of their labors pay off and of their investment. The thoroughbred breeding business has really grown and thrived in states in which other forms of wagering are permitted at the racetracks. Larry mentioned to you some of these states, and as did Dave. But in West Virginia, in the past 10 years, the number of mares bred in West Virginia has increased 133% over the past 10 years. In Iowa, the number of mares bred and the foals raised in Iowa have increased 168% in that same time frame. New Mexico has had a 42% increase. Louisiana, 31% increase. During this time frame, and Oregon has experienced approximately 25% decrease in the number of foals raised here. Now I'm going to, you know, maybe pat myself a little bit on the back and say maybe that, you know, our own farm is responsible for making this number not quite as bad as it was, because fortunately we are attracting a lot of mares from out of state. We're getting mares that come to our farm to be bred from Canada, from California, from Washington, from Idaho, because we have, you know, invested very heavily and have been very fortunate in getting some, you know, very, very good quality stallions here. This year, we will probably generate over $300,000 in our farm's revenue from out of state. And I think that, you know, that is a credit to us. And in Washington, during the same time frame that Oregon's full crop has dropped about 25%, Washington's full crop has gone down 45%. And, you know, that's in large part because of the closure of Long Acres and then the subsequent time that it took to get Emerald Downs opened back up. Our farm hires, you know, we have currently about 13 to 18 full-time employees depending on the season, and, you know, we are only one of many such farms in Oregon. We hire many unskilled laborers, and Dave talked about the unskilled laborers, but along the way, these people don't necessarily make a lifelong career with us. But the good thing and the wonderful thing about horses is they're very good teaching tools for people. And it makes, you know, these young people that come to work for us, they learn responsibility for, you know, having to get up every day to take care of the horses. They learn farm management skills. They learn equipment operation, farm equipment. They learn farm construction and some building stuff, because we're always, you know, building and repairing fences and building new buildings and so forth. They learn how to do that. They learn equipment maintenance, you know, skills that they can take on to improve themselves in, you know, other jobs. And, you know, Oregon, this thoroughbred breeding industry is very, very, very important to Oregon. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's an industry that generally operates kind of quietly in the background, and, you know, we don't see it. But, you know, this bill is, you know, I think very, very essential to helping our industry both survive and then hopefully, you know, grow and prosper in the future. And I thank you very much for your support.
Thank you very much, Mr. Root. Questions of either Mr. Nielsen or Mr. Root? Yes, Representative Riley.
I'm not sure. I don't think this is a question for them. I just wondered if Mr. Penn is going to be testifying on this.
I don't have him signed up to testify. However, we can bring him forward if you'd like, Representative.
Well, then let me just ask this question of Mazin. And we have this amendment to this bill that were handed today. And the way I see this amendment, it looks like we are being asked to set the take for the percentage take for the racetrack. And from what I heard earlier, we're not allowed to do that.
It's,
I just wondered if
do we know the source of this dash one amendment?
Mr. Chair, that's Magna's amendment. And again, for the record, Dave Nelson, I also represent Magna Entertainment. So that is Magna's Magna Entertainment's proposed amendment. We've been discussing that with the Oregon Restaurant Association just very briefly out in the hall, and I think we would have to do some further discussion on that before we come back with the preferred final amendment, I suppose, would be the way you'd say that.
So that's yours, Dave, on behalf of Magna Entertainment?
Yes, that's correct.
We haven't seen it prior to the time of the hearing.
Right. It was just delivered to us, and staff did not do any kind of a staff measure summary on this particular amendment. So, while I appreciate the fact that I've told our committee members that we will try to avoid this from happening, sometimes it will happen. I apologize. Further questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you,
Jack. Now let's see. We've got Jeff Murata signed up from DHS. Please enter and sign in, Jeff.
Chair Brettler, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Murata. I'm the Problem Gambling Services Manager with the Department of Human Services.
Which gaming services?
Problem Gambling Services Problem Manager gaming. With the Department of Human Services, Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services.
Thank you.
I'm here to discuss with you an important issue associated with House Bill 2671. As you know, House Bill 71 proposes to increase the number of video lottery terminals from 10 to 50 that may be placed on race meet premises. And this bill really raises a fundamental question that was raised earlier this afternoon, and that is, what constitutes a casino? As you're aware, the Oregon Constitution prohibits casinos. If this bill were enacted, a policy would be established that implies 50 electronic gaming machines in one establishment is not a casino. This liberal interpretation of what is not a casino would clear a roadblock to the widespread expansion of electronic machine gaming, which is the most addictive form of gambling known. So I urge this committee to look beyond the face of this bill and consider the underlying ramifications that this bill presents. This bill could provide the foundation to expand gambling beyond what is good for Oregon. This concludes my prepared testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Murata. Questions for Mr. Murata? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just clarifying. I understand your position. And I guess what you're saying is that the Department of Human Services and the governor are opposed to this. Is that what we're saying here?
Chair, Representative Boquist. We're taking a neutral position at that time. I haven't had the opportunity to consult with the governor's office, and I don't know his position. I just wanted to bring this issue to this committee's attention that this could be clearing some roadblocks for future actions to expand gambling.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, in more of a comment, Mr. Chair, because Representative Galizio raised this issue, and what is a casino? And, you know, what qualifies one way or the other? And the last time I checked, it was the governor's budget that had the blind games in it and going down that road. So I'm only slightly confused here, Mr. Chair, throughout the day's testimony.
I appreciate that. And do we have any information relative to the governor's position on 50 versus 75? We had heard earlier that perhaps 50 versus 75 was a breaking point at some point for the governor.
Mr. Chair, I'm not in a good position to speak for the governor's position on this. My concern primarily is that this could create it as this could create a the bridge to a policy that can that would de facto allow establishments 50 up to 50 terminals. Because it would in fact, well, it wouldn't, the policy would be that it wouldn't be a casino. Now, that could be challenged, certainly, and there isn't a clear definition. That's part of the problem. However, if this bill moved forward, there would be momentum that the definition was not that 50 machines was a casino, and it's very complicated. My concern is seeing these mini casinos pop up everywhere like we have in other jurisdictions as an unintentional consequence down the road for a bill such as this.
Follow-up, Representative Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you aware, can you give us any background on pardon me if I make sure, Magna's, does Magna have a addiction program and do other casinos and establish, I believe in the lottery, isn't there an addiction prevention and addiction services program? And do they pay into it? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, the Oregon Lottery contributes 1% of its revenues into a gambling treatment fund, and those revenues are used to support an extensive service of prevention and treatment for problem gamblers. The monies that my office oversees is exclusive to that 1% of Oregon Lottery revenues dedicated for that purpose. I'm not aware of what programs the Magna has in place to deal with harm mitigation or other casinos. I suspect they have some, but I couldn't really speak to the extensive or to the nature of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does your department have a position what the governor is recommending right now about Cascade Locks with casino?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I believe we're taking the department has taken a neutral position on that. And again, I can't speak for the governor's office.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio.
I don't have a question regarding the governor.
You're the only one.
I want to preface that. So, I have two questions. One is the status quo allows 10, and the bill asks for 50, and you're opposing 50 because that, for you, perhaps constitutes a casino or we're worried. So can you give us a number that you would find okay? And then my second question is investing in the stock market, is that gambling?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, in terms of the number that would constitute a casino, I don't know if it would work on the basis of a sheer number. I think it's probably a much more complicated equation than that. Again, my concern regarding this particular bill isn't so much whether or not it supports the racing industry. And the face value of this bill, I'm not terribly concerned about it, the increasing from 10 to 50. My concern is opening the door to future attempts to bring a large number of electronic gaming machines, up to 50, into other establishments because this would set a precedent to do so. The whether or not stocks, playing the stock market, is a form of gambling. You know, again, it depends on the definition. I would say the majority of people in the field feel that if stocks were put into the market on a long-term basis, that is not gambling. However, a form of day trading would be considered gambling.
I guess I'm hooked. Jeff, are there a lot of applications for folks to go to 10 gaming machines at this particular time?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any applications to increase that, nor would I. That might be a question better directed to.
So you don't know of any rush to the door to put in 10, so if I'm just trying to figure the logical nexus mm-hmm. between an application to go to 50 and this unique facility, and where it's had 10 mm-hmm. as a unique facility.
and then to move to 50, why other folks would believe that they should be entitled to, if they haven't felt like they were entitled to 10, how do you make the jump that they feel like that they should be entitled to 50?
I think it's well known that the Constitution doesn't allow for casinos, and there hasn't been, I believe, a lot of attempts to create establishments that may be considered casinos due to that factor, that impeding factor. What I'm concerned regarding this particular piece of legislation is that it will either remove or substantially reduce that barrier for persons seeking to build such an establishment.
Okay. Let's see. Other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Morata. And we have Mark Nelson signed up on behalf of Oregon Restaurant Association. Mark?
I find this extremely interesting. I mean, your question, Brian's
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, today representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. I'll be very brief. The association at this point in time is neutral on the bill. We, as you might expect, have concerns about competition and what this type of facility might bring. But again, at this point, as the bill is written, we are neutral. We do have a concern, which we've expressed just prior to the meeting with Mr. Nelson and Mr. Campbell, regarding the amendment. As the Legislative Council opinion that I gave to you indicated, we do not believe that we believe it's the Commission's responsibility to set the rate and not the legislature. And this particular amendment clearly has you setting that rate. I think there are some different ways to perhaps solve this problem and not confront that issue, and that's I would like some opportunity to discuss that with the proponents. The other issue, too, is that currently, as you, I think, understand, is that depending upon your sales, you have different rates. The lottery retailers now, if you're the one, I think it's called the B schedule, if you sell zero to $650,000, it's a 23% rate. 650 to 1.8 million, it's 18.5% rate, and 1.8 million and up, it's 12% rate. So what's being suggested here is a different rate structure than what that rate structure is. And we may be fine on that. It's just something we need to spend some time on. We do have a basic concern about who sets the rate. So I'd like the opportunity to discuss this with the proponents and come back to you with some type of modified amendment.
Sounds like you have some additional work to do at this point, then, Mark. Fair to say? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nelson, for bringing this forward, because you anticipated the question that I was going to ask in light of the previous discussion, and I'm glad you're here as a better-looking version of Bill Perry.
You're already in trouble, Vicki. Don't try to get out of it.
Further questions of Mr. Nelson? Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it. I have no further folks testify on behalf of House Bill 2671. Looks like there's some discussion that needs to go on between the principal parties. I would encourage you to also engage Mr. Penn in that discussion. Representative Mark was signed up on this bill, but he's already testified.
He's already testified.
With that, we will close the public hearing on 2671 and open the public hearing on 2691. Madden?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this Bill 2691 also has a nexus type of thing to it, that it allows the placement of three video lottery terminals into liquor stores. And the nexus is that the OLCC is involved in this, since they are OLCC stores. However, the nexus breaks down when the OLCC stores don't serve alcohol.
Drink.
Right. and they're not an establishment for that. They are an establishment for retail of alcohol. And that basically where the differences are in the definitions of what it is. So this is assuming that the lottery or the video games are basically also a retail type of commodity rather than entertainment that would be placed in the entertainment section of the industry. There's about 239 liquor stores in Oregon, and two additional ones are opened every year. One of the issues that is clear in this bill, it sunsets this whole experiment in January 2nd, 2008, and that's why it gives the impression that it's some sort of a pilot program of where the issues might be examined. If that is really the case, then the amounts and work in putting all these machines in the stores might or might not be finished by the time, or might not show it is ability to work in that well. So I think in order to make it a successful pilot as it is crafted, probably more definition of that pilot needs to be defined, if you will, in order to be able to put a revenue impact on it in the sense that we are looking at. Having said that, and having satisfied these assumptions, we'll be able to look at about $4.3 million increase a biennium in revenues if all the previous assumptions are established.
4.3 million?
Right.
So by name?
Yes, sir. But of course, by the time we're close to that, then the sunset occurs and we're no longer getting that amount. So.
Thank you. Dale Penn, Director. We've already had testimony on the record from Representative Steve March in favor of this. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. The lottery is neutral on this bill. However, we did have concerns about the sunset clause, and I think you just heard some discussion about that. The liquor stores are a unique environment. It is different than the business environment that we have machines in now. We have real concerns about trying to hook into an amount that we would expect a machine to produce in this environment, because it is right now, at least, a situation where people go there, they're there for a few minutes, and they're gone, as opposed to staying in a liquor store. And then the square footage of the liquor store is also an issue. I think you heard that addressed just very briefly. I haven't been into a lot of them, but they're pretty tight as far as the amount of square footage. Our issue is simply that if it is going to have a sunset clause, if you took all of the liquor stores and said that they wanted to purchase three, or they wanted to have three machines, we'd have to go out and buy 770 machines, basically, or 717 machines. We'd have to make an investment there of about $6.5 million. And so I realize that not everyone will utilize three machines, but just the concept, if we're going to make that capital investment, there should be some period of time to recover that investment back. That's our only issue. We can't go out and sell Oregon Lottery machines. No one else will buy them. They're programmed specifically for Oregon. So that's the only issue we want to bring.
So Dale, you buy your machines as opposed to leasing your machines?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, presently we have, and that's one of those things that has been helpful to us. Right now we have machines in the field that are 10, 12 years old. We paid them off a long time ago. They're still producing a lot of revenue. It is something to take into account, but the purchase, I suppose that is one way to do this. If you had a smaller number, We could lease those and perhaps try to match that up. But there are some unknowns here in these dollars. And when we gave a figure of $4.3 million, that was with 717 machines out there, being the lowest category of operator that we have now, but we don't know if that really will match up just because of the differences in the business environment.
So I understand that these machines that you do have can be used for many other kinds of activities in addition to gaming. Can they be used for anything else other than just gaming in Oregon?
No, Mr. Chair, no, they're just straight gaming machines. Yes.
And finally, don't you have money set aside to replace machines now?
Mr. Chair, we have some. We are in the process, though, because of line games. We're about half of our number of machines are obsolete. They are old, and many of them do not play line games at present time. So we're challenged to try to replace those at the present time.
But you do have some reserve set aside to do that.
Yes.
Okay. How much is that reserve, Dale?
This going out of this fiscal year, I'd expect it to be around $25 million.
So by the end of the current fiscal year, $25 million, and the estimate here for 717 machines would be $6.5 million approximately.
Beyond the $25 million, yes.
Beyond the $25
yes. Because I'm talking about, when we talk about replacing of machines, there's approximately 5,500 machines right now that are obsolete, that are not supported, both software and hardware, and about 3,000 of those machines do not play line games at all. And so we're making efforts to try to replace those in a staged manner. And we expect to utilize dollars from this biennium, and then we're going to be challenged in the next biennium to try to continue to roll out more machines.
Okay. Questions to Mr. Penn? Yes, Representative Bill.
I have a question to staff before Mr. Okay. Penn disappears here. The relating clause that was briefed, it sunsets on January 2nd, 2008. Where in 2691 does it sunset?
Section 3, the last one.
Amendments become operative on January 2nd, 2008. I can't find the sunset clause, Mr. Chair.
Well, while we have Maz look for that, thank you very much, Dale.
Thank you.
We'll get back. We have signed up, let's see, from Eastside Liquor Store, John Elberstein.
Yes. Mr. Chair, do you want me to explain that?
Yes, would you please, Dale?
The Section 2 basically takes out the liquor store. So it puts it in Section 1. Section 2 takes it out. So Section 2 is operative after January 2nd, 2008. So that's a way council introduces new law and then takes it out at a certain time.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, it reads me amendments to ORS 46127 by Section 2 of this becomes operative on January 28th.
Mr. Chair.
How does Section 1 prevail over the top of Section 2 if you're not repealing the line items in Section 1?
Mr. Chair.
You
go to Section 1, Representative Borquist, and in line 16, it injects the new language on liquor stores. So it makes it permissible for liquor stores to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Once it has done that, then it goes in Section 2 and back in line 8 of page 2, it takes out this liquor store allowance. And it makes Section 2 operative on
on that January 2nd, 2008. So it put it in now, and then in 2008, January 2 takes it out, and that's how it brings it in and takes it out at a different time.
Representative Boquist?
So I guess I'm trying to understand, because Representative March is not here, that Representative March's effort here was to experiment and see if this works or not, if this is a pilot program?
I'm assuming so, with that short sunset. And I don't know, maybe the liquor agents can talk to us about that too. John?
Good afternoon, Chairman Butler, fellow members of the committee. My name is John Feierstein, agent of Eastport Liquor in Portland. I'm testifying today in favor of allowing video machines in liquor stores. My reasons are as follows. Enhanced customer service. Our customers are requesting video poker, especially after the addition of the line games. A friendly, smoke-free environment. Request for video poker comes from customers that did not go to bars or taverns. It would be profitable for the Oregon Lottery. The dozen or so liquor agents I've spoken with that would add video poker already are lottery retailers, eliminating the expense of having to set up first-time lottery retailers. My main business is responsibly selling liquor for the state of Oregon. I feel the addition of video poker would not detract from that, but add a level of enjoyment for our clientele. And I would, in adding to Representative March's testimony, if this were, I would have to say, wildly successful, I certainly would consider opening holidays on a year-round basis and probably afford a few more benefits for my people. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Feinstein? Feierstein? Representative Berger? Feierstein, right?
Feierstein.
Make a pardon.
Mr. Feierstein, it's hard for you to come in here and speak for all liquor store owners, and I appreciate that, but I have some sort of nuts and bolts questions, and I know that you could probably only speak for your own facility. Do you know if all liquor stores are retailers, lottery retailers now?
No.
They are not?
No.
Do you have a sense for the space requirements here and what it would take to put in this particular thing? Clearly you think you have it in your, you have one store, you have more than one store?
One store.
Your store. Do you think most would or some would, or do you understand?
No, I think at most it would be some.
Some. So
I would think in 5 years it was very successful in the testing liquor stores. I doubt a third of liquor stores would put video poker into their stores.
Would you see a possibility here for a sort of test market way of doing this?
Sure.
Rather than just authorizing blanket into all stores?
Oh, absolutely. I look at it as a test. I don't want to tie up the Oregon Lottery's valuable machines in my store if they're not working. And I don't want to tie that space up if it's not working. And I should be able to tell within probably a year if this thing's going to fly or not. I think with the addition of the line games, that's what made it attractive to me as a liquor agent. I don't want people in the store loitering. But right now, they play Keno. They play the little break open machine. And they're as they're making a purchase, exiting, they play this game. So I think the addition of the line games, it's kind of a quick transaction and out the go. They're not going to sit there and play the thing for hours at a time, as far as I can see. And that's not really what I want.
Well, so you, excuse me, Mr. Chair, yeah.
Me.
So if there were some way to do a pilot here rather than all making it available to all liquor stores, you think that would be a reasonable
sure.
way to go?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Further questions from Mr. Feierstein? Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Representative Wright, I beg your pardon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. How much inventory do you think you would have to reduce to make the space for these machines?
Zero. I've already allocated space that's a related product. In other words, shot glasses, glassware, mixer. that I can incorporate other shelving within the store and allocate space that way. So I imagine it would be 50 square feet out of my 2,500 square foot store.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Sounds like perhaps in order to do this, there'd have to be a lottery amongst those that would want to have the lottery.
Yeah, I think
that's the next.
Moses.
Right.
The next.
Lottery.
Mark Nelson. Lori. I guess they'd have to make an application and then go through.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, again representing Oregon Restaurant Association, appearing in opposition to House Bill 2691. Our concern here is we've established a system for video poker terminals in an on-premise location. That is, as in Mr. Penn's written testimony, a drinking restaurant establishment. This is a very slippery slope. If you go to an off-premise to provide these machines, you're then opening up the door, and it's a policy decision for you, but you're opening up the door now to all other off-premise establishments in the state. We also represent 7-Eleven, and I'm here to tell you at this point in time, 7-Eleven stores probably would not reconfigure their space to put in three video poker machines. But I can guarantee you that there are many, many, many other grocery outlets that would seriously consider providing that. They could incorporate a space that would be off limits to minors to meet those kinds of objections and those kinds of requirements that occur today on-premise bars and taverns. But you're opening up a whole brand new area here, and we clearly have a concern, obviously from a proliferation point of view, as I indicated in previous testimony, but we think that this is a very, very major change as to where these video lottery machines are going to be located. And there is just as strong an argument, I would guess, made by the liquor agents, could be made by other grocery outlets that currently sell the other lottery games, and our lottery retailers now except for video poker, which is restricted to on-premise. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
It's my understanding that liquor stores are not off-premises for minors.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The liquor stores are off-limits to minors. And
they are off-limits?
They are off-limits to minors. So that a minor cannot enter a liquor store. And so I understand that problem in terms of liquor stores to take care of, because minors are not allowed, but it's no different in a medium-sized grocery store to set off a portion of that store and put in your three video poker machines and make that off limits to minors as well. That's what I mean. It's a slippery slope as you go to the off-premise location.
John, is my understanding wrong that liquor stores, would you like to come forward, please?
Mr. Chairman, I should take part of that back. There are stores that are mixed in small towns, locations where they sell other products. They are allowed to buy license to have, and children can come into, let's say, a pharmacy that also, so I think in Sisters, there is one of those, where they sell other items. I think people under 20, minors under 21 are allowed there. Okay. A straight liquor store, but maybe he can answer better.
You got both John Steubenvall and John Firestein.
A child may enter a liquor store with a parent, right, or a minor married to a person of 21 can enter a liquor store.
Yeah.
But they can't in no way
just loiter there.
Right.
So minors, John Steubenvall, is that your understanding?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, John Steubenvall of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, yes. And again, I guess as Mr. Nelson just discussed, there are those different types of liquor stores. In our rural communities, we have what we call the non-exclusive stores, where you may have a grocer, a pharmacy, a hardware store that's also the town's liquor store.
But adults can bring minors with them.
Is sure, as long as there's some legal relationship there, as was just discussed.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I stand corrected on the rigor.
No, I remember that we heard that one time previously in a ways and means process, and I was shocked that parents could bring children into a liquor store. Further questions of Mr. Nelson?
of the Oregon Restaurant Association. Thank you very much, Mark. And Philip Kennedy Wong, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Are you going to want to apply to have these in the ministries, synagogues, churches? I hope not. I mean, we talked about the slippery, sliding slope and everybody opening their doors.
Well, maybe, bingo, but...
Okay.
Church bingo. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I'll keep my comments very brief. We like to go on record as opposing House Bill 2691. We do believe that there are plenty of opportunities for people to take advantage of video gaming without having to go to liquor stores. And although we are obviously sympathetic to those who may be allergic to secondhand smoke, but that doesn't mean that they have a right to gambling to that extent. It's our understanding there are 242 liquor stores in the state of Oregon, so you multiply that by three, that's 72600 new video poker or video games, line games that we're adding to the state current total of, I think, close to 10,000, if not more. I think Mr. Murata can probably answer that more definitively, but that is a lot of opportunities for people to get their gambling entertainment. We don't believe that liquor stores is a viable option, because when you look at it, it's essentially a retail environment, and it's remarkably different from a restaurant or a tavern environment, and it does open the door potentially for other retail establishments like the ones that Mr. Nelson raised. So we are concerned about that, and I don't want to go back to another bill, but after hearing Mr. Murata testify on House Bill 2671, in terms of his concern of creating a precedent of 50 terminals or more, that would raise a concern to EMO in terms of what is the definition of a casino if 50 video lottery terminals is not considered a casino. So I understand, obviously, that's up for the courts to decide, but I'm not sure if we necessarily need to go down that route yet.
Thank you, Philip. Questions of Philip? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. I have no other testimony signed up on behalf of House Bill 2691. Hearing and seeing no further testimony, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2691 and open the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 30.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we reached a grand finale with the House Joint Resolution 30.
Might as well change the Constitution while we're at it. Okay.
And this proposal to change the Constitution, amended to reflect that the net proceeds of the state lottery would be dedicated, some of it on or to natural disaster relief in Oregon. And also this constitutional amendment establishes a disaster relief fund, and this fund would be in this constitutional amendment funded at the 1% level.
Does my daughter's bedroom qualify under that?
Disaster fund?
Disaster relief.
Disaster relief fund. I think if my daughter's bedroom will be qualified, your daughter's.
We're expanding the definition of a disaster zone. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I've put in the background material in the SMS where lottery funds by constitutional requirements go today at 18%. Education stability, and then if it's 5% of the general fund, it'll go down to 15% for the school submatching account, 15% to parks and recreation, and then by statutes, the sports action goes to intercollegiate athletic fund, and you have 2.5% to counties economic development, and about 1% or up to 1% to the problem gambling addiction fund, and about 1% to the county fair accounts. So this puts on top of these dedications a 1% to the amounts in the net proceeds to the disaster relief fund. That will be no new money, of course, no new revenue into the system at all, but it basically will take away from what is left to the legislature to allocate
for economic development
or education or what is allowable uses for the lottery funds. So that will basically about be $10 million of biennium going away from that legislatively allowable dedication.
Questions of staff? You've heard the testimony from staff indicating that 1%, if we were to move 1% from the available lottery sources, that we would be moving $10 million into a dedicated fund for disaster relief. Further discussion, Representative Boquist?
Mr. Chair, just to make sure I completely understand, is we're saying is it'd be 1% in addition. So it's these are the general fund dollars we're talking about here, and it's not taken away from any of the above programs.
That's my understanding. It does not reduce any of the constitutionally dedicated. However, this would require an amendment to the Constitution to move this additional 1% towards the disaster relief fund. And the concern, of course, is that then moves it away from the economic development original intention of the lottery, but would then have basically that we have discretionary authority over everything that isn't presently allocated here. So it would make another $10 million off limits as opposed to in times of disaster setting aside disaster funds. I'm assuming that it establishes how the disaster fund would build and grow and retain its own. Is that what,
No, Mr. Chair, not necessarily. It's just at this time, I think this is a constitutional amendment, and then we probably will be looking at further details.
Then establishing the proviso as to how it would work. So there is a possibility that our teenage daughters' bedrooms could qualify as disaster areas.
And I suspect they still have to go through Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
I suppose that's Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, this came from the Committee on Trade and Economic Development. Is there any historical background or any?
Yeah, they got wild and crazy one day. I think what happened. That's the historical background. Further discussion? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Resolution 30 and we'll close the committee for today. Thank you very much. Okay.